Hello and welcome to J-Cell Jabber. My name is Curtis Brewer and I'm an associate professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I'm a co-editor of the Journal of Cases in Educational Leadership, or J-Cell. J-Cell publishes peer-reviewed cases for educational leaders who are in our preparation programs and for practitioners engaged in professional development. It is available online. Our goal at J-Cell is to better build a bridge between theory and practice of educational leadership, a bridge that will help educational leaders create more equitable learning experiences for communities across the globe. Each case provides a narrative and teaching notes. They're meant to be used to prompt rich discussion about issues pertinent to educational leaders.
Hello, my name is Ian Mehta, and I am an associate professor at the University of Maine. I'm one of the co-hosts for J-Cell Jabber. J-Cell Jabber is a quarterly podcast that helps highlight special collections of articles that are temporarily made available for free. It provides listeners a brief 30-minute podcast to engage more deeply in a case, and it connects the listener by reviewing the nuances of the case, engages with the author or authors to provide additional details about the case, and provides a discussion with a scholarly practitioner from the field who can discuss how to apply this in practice. In this episode, we review Dr. Alonzo Gilzean's case titled Disciplinary Dissent: The Troubled Implementation of a Restorative Justice Program at E.C. Johnson High School. This case was published in 2021 and critiques the implementation of a restorative justice program in a high school in the U.S. And if you listened to the last podcast, we have a new podcast co-host that we'd like to introduce with this episode. So we welcome Dr. Terry N. Watson, who is an associate professor at City College of New York and a prolific scholar in the field. Dr. Watson, welcome to the podcast. And please share a little bit about yourself, who you are, your research, whatever it is that you'd like to share with the audience.
Thank you. My name is Terry Watson, as noted, and I am an associate professor of educational leadership. And in terms of the work that I do, in addition to helping to prepare New York City's next generations of teachers and school leaders, I study effective school policies and work with leaders to help create beloved school communities. I think that schools, particularly those in urban areas, can be transformational places if we equip them with teachers and teacher leaders who love and care deeply for our children. And I'm excited to be a part of this conversation because the topic is important, but more importantly, the work we do is equally worthwhile. And I'm hoping that this discussion will further the implementation of restorative justice practices. So when you invited me to be a part of this conversation, I was very happy to speak with Dr. Gilzean about this important case study and how it can be applied in classrooms, not just in New York and Florida, where we both are, but in schools and districts throughout the country. Thanks for having me, gentlemen.
Well, Terry, we're excited to continue this journey with you. So welcome again to the podcast. Let's start with a review of the case. Terry, can you kick us off? I believe you're going to talk a little bit about the use of school resource officers throughout schools in the U.S.
Good evening, fellows, and thank you for letting me join you. I'm particularly happy to be a part of this episode where we speak with Dr. Alonzo Gilzean from Florida State University about his most recent case study, Disciplinary Dissent: The Troubled Implementation of a Restorative Justice Program at E.C. Johnson High School. And I know, as a Black woman and a former educational leader, that racial disparity is often palpable, not only in school discipline policies, but also in the practices, and that restorative justice was created, if you will, to make sure that schools become racially just spaces, particularly in terms of student discipline. Now, for the last few years, Black girls were disciplined in schools more than all other girls and most boys in every state in the nation, and Black children continue to be overrepresented in school discipline data. What we found is that while restorative justice is effective in some ways, it's the implementation of this safeguard that becomes problematic. And your case study, Dr. Gilzean, really hones in on the divide and the dissent, rather, that occurs in a schoolhouse wherein I'd say the school community can't get on the same page in regards to restorative justice. And I know in conversation with colleagues, we talked about even the words restorative justice, like how they themselves are oxymorons in many ways, because schools are fundamentally unjust spaces, particularly for Black and Brown and non-white children. But restorative justice is the latest thing that schools and districts are putting a lot of money and emphasis in. And what I'm hoping is that this conversation sheds to light best practices and ways to move us forward in creating racially just schools. So thank you both Ian and Curtis for having me. And thank you Dr. Gilzean for joining us. And as I stated, I spent some time in Florida and I understand what justice does not look like there. I'll say that. So with that said, I guess what I'd like to trouble is this concept of restorative justice. Ian, what do you find restorative justice to be?
So I'm going to try to give an overview for the listener, just to provide a review of the basic concept of restorative justice and its attempt really to remove the idea of a punitive framework from discipline in schools. And you mentioned sort of that tension, Terry, right? Like if that's even possible within our current system. So at its core, restorative justice is intended to repair harm that is done by one group or one person to another group or person. And because a crime or an act is a violation of trust and feelings and safety, really the goal of restorative justice is to try to strengthen and rebuild relationships and to have those connections that are vital to the health of a community. The primary focus then is to try to understand the perspective of the victim and determine their needs to repair the harm that's been done. And then secondarily, it's to also focus on the harm that's done to a community and how the community can help repair the harm through actions and promote well-being for all the community, including the victim and the offender. So central to this process is the idea that all community members, including the victim and the offender, are able to move forward with a sense of dignity and to strengthen the community. Within school systems, restorative justice is often implemented within varying degrees of fidelity. And this leads to a wide range of successes and challenges for school reforms that attempt to address discipline in schools across the U.S. In these efforts, educational leaders really need to consider a wide variety an array of variables. So that includes who's responsible for critiquing school policies that reinforce and replicate systemic racism. It's the balance of formal versus informal leadership that influences a school culture and climate. And it's the amount of training that's needed to achieve buy-in among faculty. We're talking about a very complex process and implementation, something that will likely jar long-time teaching faculty members their perceptions of what it means to achieve justice. So at its core, educational leaders need to consider the important role that teachers play in breaking down the cycle of punitive discipline and to shift towards an approach that values belonging and acknowledges the disproportionate representation in school discipline data, particularly along racial lines, but also gender and other variables. And centers the emotional, physical, and mental health of a community. So, Curtis, can you give us sort of an overview of what you saw in this case at EC Johnson High?
Sure. So we encountered Johnson High, which enrolls about 1,400 students in grades 7 through 12. And as Dr. Gilzean explains in the article, the current school demographics are 42% African-American, 39% white, 18% Latinx, and 2% other, and that 85% of students are on free and reduced lunch, with most of the total being African-American and Latinx students. Over the years, fighting between the students has been on the rise. And originally, under the zero tolerance policy, students were immediately suspended and or arrested for fighting. However, this approach, as the case explains, soon extended to minor infractions, such as talking back, or skipping school. Importantly, this has mirrored the type of policing that's ongoing in the surrounding community. The implementation of the zero tolerance policy was mainly performed by 13 SROs, or school resource officers. This was due to district policy where the teachers were to handle instruction while the SROs were going to handle discipline. And at times, local police were called in to sub for missing SROs. Well, the impetus for the shift to restorative justice approach was the result of a self-audit conducted by the principal. She found that for African American and Latinx students were three times more likely to be given a behavioral infraction when compared to their white peers. Principal Douglas attended a professional development on restorative justice. She hoped that this might help disrupt the evident racial bias in the discipline policies in the implementation at the school. However, while the move to restorative justice might have started to help, the principal would soon find out that the implementation was very complicated, as Ian just referenced. The hurdles to success included teachers who had not critically self-reflected, the district's use of SROs, and the actual layout of the facility itself. It is the complexity that of this case that makes it so compelling. So I would like for us to now bring in Dr. Gil Zien and Brian Pugh as our guests to discuss the article and their experiences. Ian, would you like to introduce them?
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to create an opportunity in this podcast where there is a little more back and forth between the author and our scholarly practitioner that we're bringing in to engage in a discussion that the listener can hear and reflect upon about the article and the topic of restorative justice more broadly. So to do that, we'd like to welcome our two guests. Dr. Alonzo Gil Zien is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at Florida State University, as well as Brian Pugh, who is a New York City Department of Education assistant principal and a doctoral student at the CUNY Grad Center. Dr. Gil Zien, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for calling scholarly practitioner. It sounds really important.
Yes, also thank you for having me on the show as well, and I'm grateful to be in this space and be able to talk about a topic that I care deeply about.
So we're genuinely excited for both of you to be here. Thank you so much for your time. And Dr. Gil Zien, we're excited to hear a little bit more about, you know, why you chose to write the article. But I'm going to start off with what I think should be a fairly easy question. And maybe we can hear from both of you on this. Dr. Gil Zien, you can start off. Why is the case of Johnson High School in implementing restorative justice, why is that so important to unpack and address with school leaders?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And I think to talk about the why, I have to talk about what brought me to this point, to talking about restorative justice in this way. So for me, I 2018, I was still a graduate student at Michigan State University, working on my PhD there. And I wanted to, even though I was really enjoying the work that I was engaging in and the classes I was engaging with and things like that, I wanted an opportunity to authentically engage with the school context again, right? So in my background, I was a city year volunteer through an AmeriCorps program working in the Miami schools to provide reading support for students back in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And I also served as administrator for a charter school in Philadelphia, right? So getting back into an educational space was something that was really important for me. And a good friend of mine who was in the program with me, Dr. Brianna Coleman, who has now gone on to work at CASEL, which is a collaborative for community sort of engagement and research, pushed me to look into the Lansing School District and connected me to an opportunity to work as a restorative justice facilitator. So for 3 years, I got an opportunity to work with students, work on conflict resolution. And for me, what was really important was seeing the ways that student behavior was changing from participating in restorative circles, from going through this process. But what was also interesting, and one of my mentors from graduate school, Dr. Cesare Warren, would always say, you have to write into the contradictions, right? Or look for tensions and things. And what I noticed was while we were implementing restorative justice in this school space, there was still a very strong carceral presence in the school's place in the form of school resource officers or even police officers from the school district. And I call them carceral symbols, carceral constructs, because we know from research that these things lead to disproportionality in school discipline based on race, right? That's literature says that and stuff. So for me, seeing a school try to uphold, in its implementation, try to uphold restorative practices, which were kind of counter to this idea of carceral structure and punitive imagination, made me really think, well, you know, what's going on here and how can we speak into that? Then to take that a step further, obviously, you know, the summer of 2020 was a time when we saw widespread loss of life at the hands, you know, Black life at the hands of police brutality. So I was thinking about the way that communities were being affected by this thing. You know, we were dealing with a racial pandemic at the same time as the pandemic, right? And thinking about the ways that even in the schools, students would react very strongly to, but before anything happened, before 2020, the students I was working with were responding very strongly to the police presence in school. It got to the point where one student I was trying to do a circle with, and my office was directly next to the SRO office in the school building, right? The SRO office and the police, the office that the police used. And one day she came in with an issue and was like, I can't speak with you in here. Let's meet in the hallway because the ops listening, right? So like that whole concept of like the carceral space made it where the student didn't feel comfortable spoke to me in that moment. And then thinking about 2020 just caused me to extrapolate further and think, you know, how are school leaders sort of tackling restorative justice, restorative practices, when our society upholds punitive carceral symbols? And that's really where this came from, or where this work came from for me.
Thank you, Dr. Gilzean. Brian, maybe you can comment on it. Dr. Gilzean talked about writing towards the contradictions. Maybe you can speak to some of those contradictions that you see, you know, in terms of as you try to bridge the theory to practice in your role. Can you unpack a little bit more about this case and why it's important to school leaders?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, early on, Dr. Gilzean, you sort of introduced the topic of restorative justice entering school spaces by making a very true statement, which was that in order to reduce suspension numbers, school leaders are out there looking for something else. And restorative justice became the method by which those numbers were reduced. And that right there is problematic, because what's happening is the exact same disciplinary structure that's been there forever, where someone writes a rule, someone breaks a rule, someone responds to the breaking of the rule, and it used to be suspension, and now it's restorative justice, if those same people who wrote the rule deem it appropriate. And then once either the suspension or the restorative justice is done, then someone goes back to class, and the circle has closed now. And the rules are still there to be broken again. And that right there, that structure is to me what makes the presence of restorative justice in schools so deeply problematic. It's not restorative justice's problem. It's the school disciplinary structure's problem. Because in order for restorative justice to work in a school, I think the way that it was designed and intended to work, right, to make right to the extent possible harm that has occurred, we have to upend that whole disciplinary structure, right? Those rules that someone writes, well, if we're really approaching this with a restorative lens, the same someone who could be the recipient of a punishment or a consequence from the rule, those people should be the ones that are involved in the writing of rules. That would be a truly restorative practice. And so it's really unfortunate that the focus has been insert restorative justice as a way to get our data to look right. Mm-hmm. When really what's happening is the carceral dynamics that you're talking about, yes to everything you said, metal detectors, SROs, all of that in schools is part of the carceral dynamic. But I would go even further to say that when restorative justice is used as part of a disciplinary structure rather than a community building structure, rather than a tool to form a sense of belonging. Restorative justice, it's just another punishment under another name. And because of that, it's part of the carceral dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. And we've dressed it up, right? We've dressed it up to look better, to be arguably less harmful. But unfortunately, these are still looked at and still feel like punishments to many of the young people. And I'd go so far as to say even some of the adults, right, who come into these spaces. And so I really appreciate the way that you laid out at the very beginning, the way that schools identified the need for this practice.
Yeah, and I'll just go ahead and I think in responding to that, I think you're absolutely correct is one of the things, and one of the things I was trying to really get at in the article was implementation and buy-in are super important. And like you said, like you just said, the implementation is still happening in a very punitive carceral framework, right? So even in our attempt to not suspend students as much, right, where if I, you know, this isn't in the article, but if I had to count out or estimate, you know, the racial dynamics of the students who were being overly recommended for restorative justice, it would mirror exactly what was happening with suspension, right? And at that point, we're still getting to bias. We're still getting to, like, teachers treating this in a punitive manner, like you were suggesting, and then this is still a form of punishment being doled out to students, right? So what I think I was really trying to get at in the article is how does a school need to really, really challenge these ideas in itself and really think about the ways that increasing that buy-in, getting teachers to understand that this is not just a punishment, this is about community, right? Getting students to understand that this is not just a punishment, but a way of building, sustaining, and maintaining like community in different ways. And I think what makes that difficult is oftentimes what I was writing, oftentimes with implementation, a school leader will have an idea, pitch it to everyone and say, we're doing this now, right? The cycles of reform, cycles of policy, we're going to do this now. And this is the new wave that we're on right now. And I think you can't do that with restorative justice because it can't occur in spaces. Maisha Nguyen says it can't occur in spaces where there are, you know, carceral or punitive imaginations, right? And that requires a restructure of the way we as a society look at crime and punishment. We as a society look at community and the ways that that's structured. And I think to implement with fidelity takes a little more groundwork to get to the point where we're imagining restorative justice can go. But like as a punitive society, that makes it difficult, I think.
Well yeah, I mean, considering this idea of the punitive society and then the real promise of justice to do the work we've been talking about around building community and sense of belonging, you know, the buy-in comes when the practice is engaged with, when we're not addressing harm, right? We're engaging with the practice just to form community, just to get, sometimes it's just getting to know each other. Sometimes it's getting to know what one another have experienced, believe or aspire to, or all those kinds of things. Because then what happens, right, when the practice is engaged with in ways that where no one's mad, right? No one's afraid of being punished. Then what we're actually doing, not only are we learning to be with each other, learning to care for and love each other, but we're also sitting in the structure of a circle, right? We're passing a talking piece. We're practicing speaking and listening in ways that are fundamentally healthy. And then higher, when there's been an argument or there's been a fight or whatever the thing is, that rule someone wrote has been broken, then we're coming together in a way that's familiar. Then it's not, oh, let's go do this restorative justice thing. What it is let's go sit and talk in the way we always talk. And that is something that makes this practice so less threatening and healthier. And then I would go farther by saying, you know, often it's not only the SROs that are the ops in the school, right? A lot of times it's that adult who's leading the circle, right? Mm-hmm. Who's this external authority figure who has no idea what's going on? practitioner experience, I will tell you that I did not feel ever like this was working. However we define working, it never felt 100% uplifting until it was the least powerful members of the school community who were the ones who were facilitating the conversation. And so when you have the kids, right, when you have the students mm-hmm. who are coming together, they are making the introduction and they are moderating the conversation, then something incredible is happening because power's been destabilized.
I am thinking about the work of one of my colleagues at the Graduate Center. She speaks about life. She says, where life is precious, life is precious. And it was Ruth Gilmore. Mm-hmm. And how do we help? And we can't put it on schools because schools, as we know, are microcosms of society. How can we make society see the value of life, but Black life in particular? Because the ones who hurt the most when these reform initiatives fail in these policies that are written without young people in mind are overwhelmingly marginalized children and communities. Because when you discipline a child, discipline the family. You know, it's not just the child you hurt. That child has to go home now to a community and tell what you did to them. And so how do we remove the punitive nature from schooling? Because we know it hurts Black people throughout history. Schools have been hostile spaces, liberatory for many of us, but not for all of us. And that's the problem. It doesn't work for all of us. So what can we do, not instead of restorative justice, but to reimagine or begin again with restorative justice practices? Because I think there is some promise, but they mimic too much of the carceral continuums that Carla Shedd speaks about in her work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what can we do? What do you think our next steps should be?
I think I would echo, for me, I would echo what Brian was saying earlier, is I think it's revisiting the framework, right? And saying that the goal and the orientation behind restorative justice is emancipatory through community, right? The idea of community. And Dr. Watson, to your point, it shouldn't start with the schools, because schools can't be a panacea for the ills of society, as you stated. But I do think it's a reorientation of school leaders, at least in the school sphere, towards, and there's a lot of newer work in the field of education administration talking about this, reorienting the school leader to more of a community leader, engaging the voices of community members to kind of create change in a more inclusive, holistic way. And I think where restorative justice gives us a framework for that is in the circle method, right? Having the opportunity to, before any conflict happens, before any issue happens, have spaces where people can come, community build, work together, talk together, things like that, as a preemptive strategy, as opposed to reacting to some sort of harm and stuff like that. And I think it really comes down to, at least for me, this building of community through that process. And at least as far as practitioners or school leaders can control, that would require opening up school spaces to, and you know, at the end of the day, Black school leaders have already been doing this, right? Like my dissertation was looked at Detroit, Michigan, and the school principals in Detroit, Michigan are already engaged in community in ways that often go unsaid or unheard and things like that. So I think getting more people to buy in the ways that people are already navigating in building community, in bringing people into spaces, but with intention and preemptively, so we're not always responding or reacting to things. And I think that kind of helps shift things from this punitive carceral structure to more of like community. It's all about community, I think. But Brian, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree. And I also just want to bring up something that I don't think we've explicitly said, which is that these are places for teaching and learning, and that the idea of a restorative way of being happen when we've designated the time to fortify and build community, or we've designated the time to respond to harm. But when we can build in, and I think this happens on an individual school level, right? As Dr. Watson said, schools are microcosms, right? But we can build right into school policies things that are essentially restorative. We accept late work. We allow for revisions, right? We allow our school spaces to be spaces that are not performative, but rather they're spaces where we can struggle in safety, that we can try things out and not be humiliated or embarrassed or shamed for it, right? And all of those things feed into what is overall a way of being essentially restorative, where we are in a longitudinal type of way using relationships to show one another that we care enough to take a risk or support the risk taker, and that we feel loved and accepted for doing it. You know, Dr. Watson is she and I are sitting in this room together, right? She was my advisor at City College like 8 years ago, and now it's like the circle is closing because she's my advisor again in a different program somewhere else, and that is. Dr. Gilzean, I think you used the term caring community or continuity of care, right? That's like what these reciprocal relationships are when we, over the course of time, show that this is a supportive environment with supportive relationships. And then it all then does the work of fostering community, preparing for hardship, right? And then having the tools to, having the tools in place to address hardship when it comes. Yeah, Ian, you gave a really great definition of restorative justice, and I just wanted to add something to it, which is that Howard Zurr, who is one of the most famous practitioners of restorative justice in America, he is reticent. He hesitates a lot to define the practice, and he does that because as he says at great length, that the participants are the ones who shape the practice, right? This is a human endeavor. There is not a single brand or a manual that we're following, because if it's restorative justice, each member at the table is shaping each experience. And so he hesitates at great length in the little book of restorative justice to define it. And he even says, many scholars in the field fear that there's a level of, you know, sort of being a know-it-all about it, because each person brings something. And I think we're talking a lot about that today in the community building.
And I just want to continue on that. I think that's what's so scary or so difficult for people, is the fact that across the literature, that we're telling people, you know, where we are naturally trying to look for order or organization, and especially as a school leader, it's all about trying to organize things or order things in ways that increase the efficiency of the school, or even like, you know, just make sure that things are running all right in the school space. And I think bringing a process that is intentionally supposed to be decentralized, intentionally supposed to be iterative, collaborative, considerate of all of the parties. And like Brian said, everyone's bringing a different perspective. Everyone's bringing a different component, is frightening when we're looking for order, right? But I think that's the beauty of restorative practices, right? Like that the order comes from the individuals who are participating in there. And I think that's a part of what makes implementation so difficult, right? Is the idea that, as Brian said earlier, we have to share power structures with the least powerful individuals in the school buildings. So now you're telling teachers and faculty members that they have to come into space as a school and accept the fact that everyone's voice is going to be considered for the maintenance or running of that community in school and things like that. And I think we are conditioned in ways that makes it difficult to approach a situation without that type of order. So I think it really comes down to reframing, thinking about these possibilities of what does it mean to undo these systems. And approach this place from a truly collaborative community-based space. And I think that is really important. And I'm glad you brought that point up.
You know, it's like, as you were talking, Dr. Gilzean, I was thinking like this question we hear a lot in schools, you know, did I do it right? Was it done right? And I think with restorative justice, you know, did you listen? Did you speak honestly? Was harm addressed if that's what we're gathered for? Or was community fortified if that's what we're gathered for? Because if you listened and you spoke honestly, but that's the extent to being able to identify, you know, the correctness of it because of everything that each participant brings.
Yeah, so a question I have is, if you were to imagine a professional development for principals and this article was utilized, what would that look like? Or how would you hope they used it?
I think one thing that I'd want the takeaway to be from that professional development is to be comfortable with the idea of removing sort of the structures, be comfortable with the idea. And I can imagine, you know, a facilitator or someone who's in charge of this professional development really presenting a bunch of data, kind of pushing, you know, one, because, you know, you have to front load the data and kind of talk about the fact that, like, here's sort of the issue that's going on right now, right? And then say, we're going to throw that away and not focus on the issue, not necessarily focus on the harm part and focus on the fact that the school is a community first. And these techniques are really ways for us to try to build stronger community, right? And talk about power structures and talk about the way that in order to properly address the issue, discipline, right? We're going to need individuals to think differently about the way that we approach every aspect of our schooling or of our school space, if I'm talking about a specific school, right? So like Brian was saying earlier, we're going to have to rethink assignments. We're going to have to rethink the way that we approach, you know, revisions. We're going to have to rethink the way that we approach individuals interacting with one another on every level of the school. And I think it would really, it would be a long professional development and probably a multi-day process, but really focusing on this idea that instead of trying to hyper-focus on the issue or hyper-focus on damage, we're going to try to center the opportunity to create a space of care, to create a space of collaboration, to create a space of community. And that's going to be uncomfortable and it's not gonna feel organized, but it's going to be beneficial in the long run. And I think that's how, it probably sounds flowery, but that's probably how I would approach that, is just saying that, like, anchoring it in, it's going to be uncomfortable, but it's gonna be beneficial because we'll be a stronger school community as a result.
Agree with Dr. Gilzean. It's definitely got to be a multi-day process. And for me, it would really start by spending some maybe half a day with principals, really thinking about and identifying the things in school that make kids, their parents, and teachers feel like they're in an environment of care. Really identify what those things are, because we don't spend enough time doing that. And identify, where does love already exist in my school? Mm-hmm. So that we know where that is, we know where our entry points are. And then the next thing that I think would be super important would be to give those principals some parallel practice experience where they go back to their schools, they sit in a circle that is perhaps led by a trained student leader, where they can come in and participate in a circle in the way that they will soon be leading their schools to do. Mm-hmm. Because there's no question about it. Every participant in a restorative justice intervention can and should walk away feeling better than when they got there, right? That's the facilitator. That's someone who was involved in a harmful situation or someone who's shown up to their advisory class to get to know their peers better. And so I think that would be an incredibly important way to kick this off. And then to really spend time unpacking the ways and identifying the ways for teachers to understand that caring for kids is not only part of the job, but it's a critical component of the job. And that it's not a punishment for anyone to learn a new way to build community and respond to difficulty that happens in a school. Because that's a big hurdle, right? That's a big hurdle that we face. You know, I've got all this content to teach. Can't it be someone else's job to respond to these behaviors, right? Or I've got all this content to teach. Can't it be someone else's job to make these kids feel good about coming to school, right? It's both sides of the coin. And so really spend time focusing on the why. Why are we doing this? And giving principals the answer to that immediately by having them experience the why in a PD.
Well, Dr. Alonzo Gilzean and Brian Pugh, I know that you have impacted me in a really positive way in sharing this space with you and in this virtual circle. I certainly appreciated what you said and how maybe we can challenge the techno-rational framework that I think a lot of leaders live in. And I think you've left us with some really good questions. I'm not sure there are always answers to them, but particularly how we can continue to challenge reframing the carceral framework. And then how do we move past really being a punitive society and the importance that schools play, right, in developing community and making sure that every child feels like they belong. Thank you so much for your time today.
You know, if I may, Ian, in naming what this conversation has been, because we have each come here to shape it, right? This has been restored. So I appreciate the learning that I was able to do from each of you by listening and for the opportunity to safely bring my truth here as well.
Yes, and I'm also extremely grateful to have been in this. I like that. I'm extremely grateful to be in this circle with you in this process of learning, growing and thinking and imagining really what the school spaces we want to see and we know we care for, especially for Black life. It's important to achieve and imagine and think and brainstorm. So I appreciate this space.
I echo those sentiments as well. You know, it's not often you can combine theory and practice. And this practice is what we often tell as a professor. We tell, you know, our students and we go into schools and we preach it, but we have to also, you know, be who we say we are. And in imagining restorative justice, I'm just listening to everyone and thinking about just calling it justice, you know, or just calling it community, or even better, a beloved community. How can we transform schools and educational spaces into places where love and care are assured and guaranteed, and so that we're not focusing on a punishment, we're looking forward to the love and the care. So thank you for helping me think so broadly about these concepts and really combining theory and practice. I think it's important, and I think it matters.
I will also echo the thanks. And I really thank you for bringing this to JCEL because we want the journal to be a place where these kinds of ideas and these kinds of imaginings can happen and start and create richer conversations for whoever engages with the article. So thank y'all for the really great conversation and deep thinking that that you prompted. All right, if you would like to access this article, please visit our special collections page linked to this podcast. Every 90 days, we will post 5 to 6 articles that will be available to everyone. If you'd like to see our whole body of work, please visit your local university library or talk with Sage about a subscription. If you have questions, you can email me directly at curtis.brewer@utsa.edu.
I'm Ian Mehta. You can email me at ian.mette@maine.edu. You can follow me on Twitter at Ian Mehta, but I don't have nearly as strong of a Twitter game as Terry does.
And that would be yours truly. I can be reached via email at twatson@ccny.cuny.edu and also on Twitter at Terry N. Watson. Thank you all for joining us. Be well.
Yeah.